created the video to just hear the story about Nikki and the life there. And I actually heard some other stories about how it wasn't that she just turned them off, but she was actually a little mean to them. She would drive her car and hit their trash can purposefully to kind of move it out of the way. And so she's actually hostile to them for about a year and a half before that happened in the video. And, you know, I'm not showing these videos because we want to praise Soma. I'm showing these videos because we want to praise God. My hope is that in the next few months, we don't have to show those videos, but we get to share our own stories of what God is doing in the midst of us. And so that's my hope, and it's not to praise anything that they're doing. It's just hopefully an encouragement to each one of us that God can use each one of us as missionaries where we live and where we work and where we hang out. So if you have your Bibles, go ahead and grab them. We're going to be in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 to 10. We're continuing our series entitled Sojourners and Exiles. And I've named it that because that's the language that Peter actually uses in verse 11. He calls us sojourners and exiles, and he says if we are Christians, we live in this world, and yet we're not like the world because we have different values than the world has. And so it's almost as if we are sojourners, almost as if we are foreigners in this world. And yet we're not just passing through the world waiting and longing to get to heaven, but we're actually called to make a life here and make a life here for a reason so that others may know who Jesus Christ is. So that's the story that Peter's been giving us throughout this whole book of 1 Peter, and he's been just kind of laying the foundation so far about who we are in Jesus Christ and what God has done so that that will push us out so that he can start to turn the corner and share what we need to be doing as a result, what God has called us to do as a result. But before we get there, let me ask you a question. How many of you, when you were a kid, played games at recess, like organized sports games, like basketball or football or kickball, where you had to have two teams? Okay, so do you remember how awkward it was when they picked the teams? You know, for some reason, there was always some weird way of picking captains. At our school, it was whoever claimed it first in the day. And so if you got there really early and you claimed, I'm first captain, then you're first captain, and somebody had to hear it. But then you'd get the captains there and everybody's standing around, and the captains would kind of fight over who's first, you know, or who, all the best players. And then they kind of got to the average players and they just kind of divided them up. And then they got to the last group, which seemed to always be the group I was in, the worst players, that they fought over who had to take the worst players. And for some reason, it was always an odd number, so you kind of, one team always had to get the two worst players. It was like a loser package that you ended up being a part of. And you knew that no matter what happened, neither team wanted you. And the team that ended up with you ended up having to make special rules and sub you in and out. And it was just the most humiliating thing as a kid. You know, as a kid, it's traumatizing. But you know what was even worse than that? What's even worse is being chosen by the captain who had no clue how to pick a team. You know, the moment that you're the last one and you get chosen on the team, you just look at your team like, oh man, we're going to get killed here. What was he thinking? Like, why in the world did he pick the teams like this? We might as well not even play. You know, as an 8, 9, or 10-year-old, it seems like nothing else is worse than being the worst player on the worst team. That's what Peter's going to talk about today. Because, you know, so often we go through life and we just feel like God has left us. We feel like we're facing rejection from people because we're following Christ. We're living for Christ. And we start to become humiliated about our Christian faith. And we start to wonder, are we the worst player on the worst team? Is it even worth living the Christian life? Because it just feels like we continuously are rejected. You know, the world tells us and the media tells us and our friends and our culture constantly tell us that it's not worth living for Christ. That's ridiculous to follow Christ. And what's actually probably more prominent around here is not people tell us that we're ridiculous for believing in Jesus, but we're actually just ridiculous for wanting our lives to line up with Jesus. You know, people are okay with us going to church, but maybe they think we're just ridiculous that we want our life to honor Christ and that we're allowing Jesus Christ to change how we think and how we act and how we talk and how we feel. And so they try to convince us to actually base our life on what the world values rather than what Christ values. That's the pattern we've been seeing throughout 1 Peter. Peter's been showing in these first two chapters so far. If you'll remember, in chapter 1, verses 1 through 1 and 2, Peter's just writing to Christians spread throughout Asia Minor, which is present-day Turkey. And he's writing to these Christians who are spread throughout Turkey, and more than likely they are in Turkey because they've been deported from wherever they're living to the edge of society because they believed in the Christian faith, because they believed in Jesus Christ. So Peter's writing to try to encourage them, because what happened is when people came to faith in Jesus Christ, their values changed. And so instead of basing their life upon the values that the Romans held, you know, honor and shame and a strong family structure and worshiping the emperor as God, they started to base their life upon Jesus Christ and worshiping him as God. And then that actually had the ability to affect the larger structure of society, because no longer were they aligning with the Romans, but they're aligning with Jesus Christ. And if you've ever been a part of a strong family structure, you know that people can get pretty angry if you try to break out of that. You know, it's not easy to break from it. Your mom or your dad or your relatives start to press on you and guilt trip you into showing up to things because it's what you've always done. And so all your relationships and your job and your very life is tied to this sort of family structure that's in place. And the family values of the Roman society actually dictated how you acted. But now that people came to Christ, they're basing their life on different values. And so the Romans started to push the Christians out. They started to push them out of their family and persecuted them to the point that they actually became unfamily, to the point that they actually were without a family. And when you're without a family, you're without an identity. And we all long for an identity, don't we? We all long to be somebody. We want to be somebody great, and we want to fit in, and we don't want to live as an outsider. We don't want to be the last person picked for the team. And so to have the Romans push them out, the first century readers starting to read this and starting to feel like, am I on the wrong team? Is this Christianity thing really what I should be doing? And yet the more that we read the Bible and we begin to understand it, our lives are shaped by the Bible, the more people are going to think that we're weird and we're different, even people who declare themselves to be Christians. So you could just imagine how these Christians were feeling. You know, people are saying all kinds of things about them, and they're pushing them to the margins of society, and they're calling them crazy for believing in Jesus and basing their life upon some person who seemed to have died. And so they're harshly treating these Christians for rejecting the culture. And so they're starting to wonder, is there any point to keep going on the Christian life? And maybe that's a question you've asked. Maybe you've have felt some sort of rejection at work or in your neighborhood or in your family because of wanting to make decisions that honor Jesus Christ. And you felt that rejection. So Peter's going to tell them today, and he's going to tell us, if you're a Christian, that you're not on the losing team. You're going to win, and that's because God is on your team. And he's not just on your team, but he's actually living inside of you, empowering you to be his presence in the world. And so Peter's main point this morning is that in you, God takes residence so that the world may know his presence. Let's go ahead and read verses 4 to 10. As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans, but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For in Scripture it says, "See, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. Now to you who believe, this stone is precious. But to those who do not believe, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and the stone that causes people to stumble, and a rock that makes them fall. They stumble because they disobey the message, which is also what they were destined for." We're not going to be able to have time today to talk about that little part, but it's amazing to see God's sovereignty even in the midst of man stumbling. And he continues in verse 9, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you've not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." There's three things that Peter's going to tell us in this section. The first is that Peter wants us to understand that God's address has changed. Before we get there, though, let's look at verse 4. Right out of the gate, we see Peter trying to encourage the first century reader and us. He says that as we come to Jesus, as we believe in Jesus Christ and believe all that he said he is, that he is God in the flesh, that he can truly forgive sins, and that he did die to bear God's wrath for our sin, and that he really did rise from the dead to give us new life in him. As we come to believe in Jesus, we're not coming to one who has no idea of what rejection looks like. We're not coming to one who can't understand what we're going through. We're not coming to one who never felt like God had left or abandoned him. We're not coming to that kind of one. We're coming to one who himself was rejected by humans. We're coming to one who understands what it looks like to be pushed outside the world's family and to be treated as worthless. And we're coming to one who received the ultimate rejection by the hands of men to the point that they killed him and hung him on a cross because they hated what he had said. You know, all throughout the Gospels, we see people rejecting Jesus Christ. You know, at one point, the religious leaders kept hounding Jesus because he was healing on the Sabbath. He was healing on the holy day of the week. Or because he was eating with tax collectors and prostitutes and sinners. Or because he was even declaring that he could forgive sins, which they believed only God could do. And in that moment, he's saying that he was God. And yet they didn't believe that. And so they kept hounding him and kept rejecting him. And then after 3 years of fulfilling Old Testament prophecy after prophecy after prophecy, at the end of his life, they finally had enough and they had him arrested and brutally murdered him by hanging him on a cross to die an excruciating death. They had finally rejected all that Jesus had said. And yet Peter says that it wasn't just the religious leaders that had Jesus rejected, that had Jesus arrested and rejected him, but it's all humans. All humans rejected Jesus. All humans for all of time who disbelieve in Jesus Christ have rejected him. But God did not. It says that God saw him as precious and chosen. God saw Jesus as the one whom the Godhead had decided before time began would enter humanity and would save us from our fate and from our slavery to sin. And so Peter is saying that Jesus Christ experienced the kind of trials that they're experiencing. He experienced rejection by humans, and yet God viewed him as chosen and precious, just like he views us if we believe in Jesus Christ. And then Peter moves on to use a couple of metaphors. And the first one is that he calls Jesus a living stone that was rejected by men. He's a stone that's precious and chosen like us, and that together we're being built into a spiritual house. So we read this and we're like, what in the world is Peter talking about? You have to go back to the Old Testament to remember what Peter is talking about. And Peter is constantly, all throughout his book, referencing the book of Exodus. And again, if we remember the book of Exodus, you'll recall that that's where God sees his people in slavery. He sees them in 400 years of harsh slavery, and his heart breaks for that, and he hears their cries, and he decides that it's enough. And so God goes and rescues his people, and he rescues them to take them into a new land where they will experience rich blessing and life with God. And as they're on their journey to this new land, God pulls them aside at Mount Sinai, and he gives them some instructions. Because this group of people have been in slavery for 400 years. They don't know what it's like to live outside of that. And so God's got to pull them aside and say, you know, I saved you for a reason. And here's the reason. And I want to tell you how to live as a result. So he had to tell them a few things. And the first, and one of those things that God told them, is that they were to build a tabernacle. They were to build a place where God's presence would dwell in their midst, where the God who saved them out of their slavery would be in their midst forever, so that they would know that God is with them forever, and that they would then live in light of the fact that the God of the universe is with them. And so if you've ever read the book of Exodus, you'll realize that almost half of the book talks about the building of the tabernacle. And what we see is that the tabernacle is essentially one ginormous tent where in the courts of the tabernacle, people would come and they would worship God. And they would make sacrifices to him in order to make a payment for their sin so that they could be right with God and receive God's favor once again. And it's where people would come and pray and talk with God. It was the hub of their religious life. It was a place that symbolized where heaven and earth would meet. And it symbolized the holiness of God and the holiness that these people, the Israelites, ought to display to the world. And it was to be the place that represented justice and peace and blessing and community. And most important is the place where God's glory dwelled. It's where the world would see how awesome and great God truly is. And if you continue in the Old Testament story, you fast forward a couple hundred years and we see that God chooses a man named Solomon, who's king. And he tells Solomon to build a temple for him, a permanent place where God would dwell. As he tells him to do that, he tells him to choose beautiful, big, beautiful stones. And as you're building, you know, as with most buildings in this time, you wanted to choose the best stones for the building. And you would choose the very best stone to be the first stone that you laid down, which was the cornerstone, because all the other stones were plumbed to that stone. And so as they're building God's house, they're going to search for big, beautiful stones. And just like any other building project, they're going to go through the stones, and they're going to look at some and say, that one doesn't meet the criteria, and they'll throw them out, and they'll reject them. And so when Peter says all throughout our section that Jesus was a living stone that was rejected, he's quoting Old Testament prophecy here about how Israel had rejected God, that Israel came to Jesus and they saw him and they rejected him and said, you're not a good stone. And it shows how Israel in the past had rejected God and that God was going to build a new temple, a new house. Not a house that was going to be built by human hands, but a house that was built by God himself. A house where because of Jesus' perfect life and his death on the cross and his resurrection from the dead to conquer sin, that Jesus himself was chosen by God to be that precious and beautiful cornerstone. The living cornerstone where all who believe in him would be built together with Jesus Christ as a new house for God. And so Peter's saying that it's in us where the glory of God would now dwell as we come to Jesus Christ. We're built up as the new temple of God, and God dwells in us now. That we will be the place where the world is able to see and hear firsthand about the glory of God. Where they would experience the peace and the blessing and the justice and rest of God. Peter's saying, we are God's new temple. God's address has changed. And Peter's saying that God now lives inside of you and inside of us together, and that changes everything. He's saying he lives inside of us. It changes everything because we don't live in this world alone. We're not living facing the trials of everyday life on our own. We're not trying to just grit it out and hope that we can get through it, but we're living with the very same Spirit of God that was in the temple living inside of us. And so it's not that God has left us. God has not left us, but the same Holy Spirit that led the Israelites to the promised land and led Jesus Christ is empowering us now. He's empowering us individually and corporately to show the world how good God is, how great God is, how gracious God is, and how glorious God is. He's empowering us to do that, and that ought to give us incredible hope and courage because we're on the winning team. God isn't just on our side, but he's actually living inside of us. We have the victor inside of us. Yet some of us have been like the religious leaders who rejected Jesus Christ. The religious leaders should have been the ones to be the proverbial builders of God's house, and yet they rejected Christ. They heard all about Jesus and all that he had done and bringing us back to God. And maybe you've heard about that, and you've heard about how we are created to live for and to honor God, and yet you've continuously looked at the life of Jesus Christ and the message of Jesus and rejected him. Some of us have completely rejected Christ. Others of us just reject whatever we want to reject. We pick and choose. And Peter says that you've actually stumbled over Jesus. As Jesus is that cornerstone that was first laid, you didn't see that stone and you actually stumbled and fell over Jesus because you disobey the word. You disobey how God has called us to turn from trusting in ourselves to only trusting in Jesus Christ for your identity, your value, and your hope. And Peter says that as you've rejected Christ, he's become the cornerstone. He's in the most prominent position of the new temple. But he says in verse 6 that if you believe in him, you will not be put to shame. You may experience heartache now. You may experience a little bit of shame now. But in the end, you will receive great honor because you believe in Jesus Christ. So friends, do you stumble over Jesus? Or do you believe in him? If you don't believe in him, I want to invite you today to believe in Jesus Christ. Let's continue. The second thing is that we are God's new priests in order to portray God's presence. Peter continues in verse 5 by changing the metaphor. He says that we're not just the temple of God, but we are actually his priests. Now, if you remember in the Old Testament, the priests were the chosen people who were chosen by God to represent God to the nation of Israel. And so they had to wear this beautiful garment that represented the beauty, glory, and holiness of God. They had to wear that to represent God to the people. And their lives were supposed to be marked by a devotion to God. And they were set apart as holy. And that was to be a distinct mark in order to show God to the people. And so they were essentially God's presence among the people, showing them that they could have access with the Almighty Creator of the universe through these men. They could know God through these men. And they also represented man to God, because man would come to them and offer sacrifices and these priests would offer these animal sacrifices on behalf of the people to God. And God would receive these sacrifices, and he would forgive them of their sins, allowing them to experience favor with God once again. But now, because of Christ's righteousness put on all who believe, Peter is saying that we are made holy. We have now become the new priests of God. If you remember back in chapter 1, verse 22, Peter says that having purified your souls by obedience to the truth, he's saying, as we have obeyed the gospel, we become holy. Then a few verses before that, he calls us to live holy lives because God is holy. And so Peter is saying that because God is holy and because Jesus Christ lived a holy life, that holy life is placed on us if we believe in him. And because we now have that holiness, all of us have the job as being priests of God. It's no longer restricted to a few people within the community, but each one of us have been given the job of being a priest to the world. And we're called to offer spiritual sacrifices. The way we portray God to the world is actually by offering spiritual sacrifices. Now, Peter doesn't get into detail right here about what those sacrifices are, but if you follow the contour of the book, you'll see that Peter has been telling us that we need to conduct ourselves with fear. And we need to love one another. And then he's going to start getting into next week and the weeks after that we need to submit ourselves to our rulers and our employers and in our marriages. That's how we show the world. So what Peter is saying is that the spiritual sacrifices that we are to offer to God as priests, so that the world may know who God is and worship him, is through our daily action. How we act on a daily basis shows God to the world. The way we love one another and the love that we have here and then the love that pushes us out to others in the world, that should be such a unique difference that the world looks at us and says, there's no way man can do that. That is utterly beyond any kind of human ability that we can muster up. And that they know Jesus Christ as a result. You know, Peter gets in chapter 3, verse 15, and if you've been around church at all, you've heard this verse a lot. You know, it talks about Peter telling us to always be ready to give a defense of the hope that we have. And we often think about that individualistically, which is true. We need to be ready individualistically. To be ready to give an account for the hope that we have. But actually, it's a command to the corporate body. It's a command to the church. You together, as the world sees your love, you together be ready to give an account of the hope that we have in Jesus Christ. As they begin to ask, why is your community different? Point them back to Jesus. Be ready to point them back to Jesus. You know, I had this opportunity a couple months ago. A few of us here at the church donated some time and some materials down to the Goodwill Hose Company. One of the leaders there started telling me how awesome I was. You know, it was awesome that you can get all these people here. And immediately I was able to deflect that back to Jesus and say, I'm not awesome. We are not awesome. We are here because of Jesus Christ, because he's awesome. And immediately, I was able, ever so briefly, to share the hope that I have in Jesus Christ. That's the kind of thing that Peter is calling us to do. He's saying that we've been made priests, and as priests, we are to portray to the world, through our loving and caring actions, the hope that we have in Jesus Christ. And the means that we do this is that we must invite the world to come and see our community in action. And we must serve the world so that they may see our love in action. Again, that's going to take us to be extremely intentional. intentional with clearing our schedules so that we can spend time together, clearing our schedules of the things that just waste our life. You know, we are the church. Yes, we come in here on Sunday morning and we do church, but we are the church scattered throughout the Susquehanna Valley every single day. And so Peter is saying that we need to be intentional. We need to clear our schedules so that we can spend time together and love one another and invite other people who don't know Jesus Christ into our community, into our daily lives. That's why I keep pushing missional communities. Because these aren't things that are just supposed to be another thing in our schedule, but it's something that should foster a love in our community. An opportunity for the world to know and to see Jesus Christ worked out. Where we're able to see, where we're able to invite friends into. And so this can be something as simple as just inviting non-Christian friends over for dinner and inviting some people from your missional community over. So as they see us interact, they see, well, that's a little different. You know, you guys are talking about Jesus, that's different. You're talking about him not in a curse word, but you're actually talking about him like he's changing your life. And they can see that, and they can see Jesus portrayed in our lives. Or we should get involved in the life of our neighbors or other parents at sporting events and love them with the love that Jesus had for us. Let's go ahead and finish. The third thing Peter says is that we are God's new people in order to proclaim God's excellencies. Look with me at verse 9. Peter uses a ton of descriptions here to show the change that has taken place. He says that we are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession. These are all descriptions that God used for the Israelites in the Old Testament. Listen to what God says to Moses in Exodus 19, 4-6. When the nation of Israel is gathered around Mount Sinai, God tells Moses to say this. We've read this before, but let's read it again. He says, "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." These are the words that you are to speak to the Israelites. And so we see here that God is calling the Israelites his treasured possession, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, the very same things that he's calling the church now, if we believe in Jesus. And so Peter is saying that those who have rejected you have been mistaken because they've also rejected Jesus Christ. And yet as they rejected Christ, they stumbled over him and will experience shame for all of eternity. But you who believe are no longer on the losing team. You have nothing to fear. You no longer have to fear the rejection of men. And no longer without a family and without an identity, but rather we're given a new identity as the people of God, as the chosen of God, as the holy nation of God, as God's treasured possession. And we no longer live in darkness, but we live in the light. And we went from being no people at all to being God's people. And we went from having no mercy to having the God of the universe, his mercy, lavished upon us. That's what we get in Jesus Christ. That's what we have. And so Peter is saying, because we have that, our job is now to proclaim the glorious wonders of God's worth. The greatness of how God has saved us now and he will save us forevermore. And the majesty and the glory of our God. Because of all that God has done. Church, that ought to cause us to rejoice greatly if we truly understand what God has done. You know, Paul mentions this in Ephesians 2. He doesn't say that God was building his temple and there was a stone here, and he picks it up. He says that we were stones that were far away from God, and God ran after us and he grabbed us and he brought us to the temple to build us up into his new temple. So we were people far away from God and he brought us near. As we've already seen in 1 Peter, that if you truly believe in Jesus Christ, his spirit is living inside of you. Just a side note, that's how you know you're a Christian. God's spirit's living in you. You can't be a Christian without God's spirit. And yet, if God's spirit is in us, then we've already experienced a number of his amazing excellencies firsthand. All that Peter's talked about, all these wonderful things that God has done, we've already experienced if we believe in Jesus Christ. So the only natural response to all that God has done in and for us is to proclaim his excellencies to the world. We do this already, right? You know, you go to a great steakhouse and you have the best steak in the world, or you get an incredible deal at the mall, and what do? You tell people about it. In church, we are on the receiving end of the greatest deal in all of history. We deserve hell, and instead we were given life with God forever. And so we ought to spontaneously be proclaiming the excellencies of Jesus Christ every opportunity we get. Because we know that God's transformed our lives. And we want our neighbors and our coworkers and our friends to know that life-transforming power that we've experienced. So let me ask you, do you know these great excellencies? Have you experienced them? Are you in awe over them? Do you marvel at these excellencies of God? And are you so overwhelmed by the incredible deal that you have received that you are individually and corporately proclaiming the excellencies of God to the world? Let's pray. Father, as we have just heard from your inspired word and the Apostle Peter teaching us and reminding us of the amazing and great and glorious excellencies of your worth and calling us to proclaim those excellencies to the world and to portray those excellencies to the world because we have first experienced them. I pray that if there are men and women in here who have not experienced those, I pray that you'd open eyes to see. Give faith to those who do not believe. And for those of us who, perhaps like me, who go on in our lives and these excellencies have become just another thing in our life, something that we don't even recognize anymore because we've taken them for granted, I pray that this week that they will be sweet to us, that each and every morning as we wake up, that we would be amazed by the fact that we have breath because that's a gift from you. And we have your love and your care and your grace. And God, that this would not feel like a weight, but this would feel like a joyous occasion to tell others about the hope we have in Jesus Christ. Because we know life would be horrific without it. I pray. In your name, amen.